My dad was hardcore into Bones for a long time, but then he was like, I can't do this anymore. They're clearly not gonna get together. He seemed to hate it as much as he loved it, because he would be like, ugh, like I hate how obviously they're trying to like sell me cars on this show. Because they have like some member of their like Bones team is like also an artist. And
Oh, yeah.
my dad was just carping that like halfway through an episode, she's like, I love this new Kia. There's so much room for all of my art in the back. And my dad's like, I don't like that. So he's like, but when are Bones and Booth gonna get together? I'm like, I'm sorry, Dad.
This is my favorite anecdote I've ever heard.
My mom was into the Moody Blues and the prog rock and a lot of other like classic rock shit, and that's why I didn't think music was good so long, because I was
you wrote
like,
off the entire
well, because
of music.
Like, because
yeah.
in your mind, music was like Air Supply,
basically.
Has anyone at this table read a James Patterson book?
I will not.
No, why would I?
And maybe I'll read, what is that?
The French one?
Trouble in Paris,
yeah.
Or whatever this book is called.
Bonjour, it's me, James Patterson.
It has, like, an alliterative name, right? Like,
Merci for murder.
Problems in Paris or something, or like...
Yeah.
Dial Merci for murder.
Yes.
Merci for
the French telephones, as we all know. Have entirely different numbers on them.
They'll
see. Bonjour.
Good day to you all, and welcome to Why Do We Watch This, the podcast where we watch a deeply bad movie, make a themed cocktail to drink along with it, talk about what we liked, what we did not like, and then we try to fix that movie at the end of it all. I am Brendan Kosher Mike Drischler.
I'm Chris Flatnose Mike Ravel.
I'm Lee Mike the Spike Delahanty.
Nicely done. There's a lot of mics in this episode, as you can tell, and you might be saying to yourself, Mike the Spike, Flatnose Mike,
what a bunch
what
of
Mike?
Dumb names.
Yes.
Well, that is just a sampling
yes.
of the rapid-fire dumb names you get
yes.
in this movie.
The many dumb names that you will hear when you watch the Guy Ritchie film King Arthur, The Legend of the Sword,
mm-hmm.
starring Charlie Hunnam and...
Jude Law.
Digimon Hansu.
Yeah.
That French lady. Or
that
Spanish
French
lady.
Some Spanish lady.
Agnes Berges.
Yeah.
Littlefinger.
Aidan Gillen. Digimon Digital
Monsters.
Yeah, we said it.
Yeah. And a bunch of other people. Like,
yep.
Think of who you could imagine being in a Guy Ritchie movie and who you would, you know, say, ah, they could probably be in a Guy Ritchie movie. Roose Bolton from Game of Thrones? Why, yes, he is in this movie.
But Ray Winstone was sick that
yes.
week.
Yeah. Well,
Ray Winstone, our theory for Merlin. New sequel.
Yep.
Yeah, no, there's recognizable faces in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it is like Guy Ritchie's Baker Street Irregulars in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, anyone who looks like they would be in a Guy Ritchie
mm-hmm.
movie is in
yeah.
this movie. So before we get into discussion of the movie, we will talk about the drink that we made for this movie. Chris, what do you have for us?
We called it kind of a play on the title of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. We made a Wages, Mages, and Less Than Two Ladies, which is a very apt description for this movie. It is 2 ounces of gin, 3/4 of an ounce of honey syrup.
With a little orange.
With a little orange thrown in, yeah. 3/4 of an ounce of dry mead and 1/4 of an ounce of freshly squeezed lemon juice.
Mm-hmm.
The syrup's very easy to make. You just boil 1/4 cup of honey and 1/4 cup of water together.
Yep.
And until it thickens and, you know, towards the end, add in some orange juice
yeah,
just for a little
just
bit of extra
it in
flavor.
Throughout slowly, I think.
We also had to, like, quintuple the recipe
yeah.
to make enough for like 3 big boy cocktails.
Yeah, apparently it was made for a wee little martini glass,
yeah.
which we don't own.
But guys, I move to say this was the most successful so far.
In a while. For me, I mean, you guys like a lot of stuff that I'm not into, frankly, and that's fine. My tastes are pretty specific. I know what I like. But this played into those tastes.
I mean, I don't know if I go so far as Chris is to say it's the best thing we've ever done so far.
No. I just mean, like, for this season of the podcast.
I mean, as of 2018.
Yeah, as of the 3 episodes we've done so
yeah.
far, sure.
Oh, yeah,
I
would agree.
Okay. It was quite good, though, I think. It would be something that I would make again and I would drink again. It was pretty easy to do, too, all things considered.
It was really simple.
Yeah.
It was not too lemony.
Yeah, it's
orangey.
Also
yeah.
really easy, I think, to do variations on it and get a good
absolutely.
Cocktail that tastes very different.
Yeah, I agree.
I said this while I was drinking it. The only thing I would change is maybe put, like, a sprig of some kind of herb.
I might have
garnish.
Made it a little more orangish also, just a little bit, but that's just me.
Yeah.
All right. So having covered the drink, we have to move on to the synopsis of the movie. Lee, would you turn to Wikipedia and try and recap King Arthur, The Legend of the Sword?
Yeah.
Godspeed to you.
Now you're going to have a lot of questions about, like, this doesn't sound like King Arthur as I remember it. So I want you guys to hold your questions, and at the end of it...
sit on your hands, everyone.
Write them down, make a paper airplane of it, and sail it into the wind. We'll never hear back from it ever again.
Poor Guy Ritchie's...
Yeah. Because it's all its own thing, right? Like, it's sort of the characters you know
doing things that you would never think they would do.
You're going to hear some familiar names, they're not going to be in the context you know them in.
And some unfamiliar names, too. Some very unfamiliar names. Lee.
All right. So this movie, we open up on seeing Mordred, an iron-fisted warlock, and his armies are laying siege to Camelot, seeking to establish the dominance of magic-wielding mages over humankind. Uther Pendragon, king of the Britons, infiltrates Mordred's lair and beheads him, saving Camelot. Uther's treacherous brother Vortigern, who covets the throne, orchestrates a coup and sacrifices his wife Elsa to moat hags.
Can we specify there real quick what we think they're actually called?
Well, they are literally called the Sirens in the movie,
yes.
So go figure. The Wikipedia will have you believe they are moat hags. He sacrifices his wife to them to become a demon knight, who kills Uther's wife and slays him in combat. The only survivor is Uther's son, who drifts away in a boat and ends up in Londinium, where he is found and raised by prostitutes. Arthur grows into a skilled fighter and a man of the streets. Arthur and his friends, his lads, confront a group of Vikings who had mistreated one of his prostitutes, forcing him to pay her restitution. Afterwards, the brothel is raided by the Blacklegs, Vortigern's minions, and Arthur learns that the Vikings were under the king's protection. Arthur tries to escape the city, but is caught and put on a ship with hundreds of other men. The Blacklegs have been forcing all men of Arthur's age to try to pull a sword that has appeared near the castle from the surrounding stone. Arthur is able to remove the sword, but is quickly overwhelmed by its power and passes out. Vortigern meets with him in the dungeon, revealing his true lineage. Meanwhile, a mage identifying herself as an acolyte of Merlin presents herself to Uther's former general, Sir Bedivere. At Arthur's planned execution, the mage uses her magic to stage a diversion while Bedivere's men rescue Arthur. Taken to Bedivere's hideout, Arthur initially refuses to help them. The mage persuades Bedivere to take Arthur to a realm called the Darklands, where he's given a vision of how Uther sacrificed himself to save Arthur and entomb the sword in stone. Arthur learns Vortigern was responsible for persuading Mordred to rebel against humanity, and he returns determined to destroy Vortigern. With his friends and Bedivere's men, Arthur stages a series of ambushes against Vortigern, culminating in an assassination attempt in Londinium. The rebels sense a trap but attack anyway, fleeing to a fighter school run by Arthur's mentor George, where they are overrun by Blacklegs.
Wait, I'm sorry. Sir George and the Dragon? Or King
this
George?
Is Kung Fu George.
Oh, okay. Kung Fu George.
Yeah.
Thank you. Say, Lee, why is he called Kung Fu George?
Well, he is of Asian descent.
Ah, all right. Continue.
Seeing the mage held at knife point, Arthur unleashes Excalibur's potential, single-handedly killing all of the soldiers. The rebels are able to escape the city, except for Arthur's injured friend, Backlack, who is killed at Vortigern's hand in front of his son, Blue. My favorite band. Ashamed of his failures, Arthur tries to throw away the sword, but the Lady of the Lake returns it and shows him a vision of England's future under Vortigern's rule. Coming to terms with his responsibility, Arthur reunites with Bedivere. When they return to the rebel hideout, however, they discover all of their allies dead, Vortigern having found them and delivered an ultimatum. If Arthur does not surrender himself, the captured maiden Blue will die. Arthur surrenders himself, but as Vortigern is about to execute his nephew, a giant snake summoned by the mage attacks and devours Vortigern's men.
Sure.
While Bedivere and the others lead an attack on the castle, a desperate Vortigern sacrifices his only daughter and is transformed into the Demon Knight, confronting Arthur in a separate dimension. Despite his fighting skill, Arthur is beaten, and he is about to submit when he witnesses a vision of his father, convincing him to accept the sword and his character as his own. Arthur violently slays Vortigern, but blesses him as he dies. In the aftermath, Arthur dissolves Vortigern's pact with the Vikings and begins building a round table where his knighted friends will meet.
I'm sorry, it was a table?
We thought it was maybe a dance floor, but...
Or some sort of giant cheese
wheel. Or a cheese wheel.
Or a stage?
Blue and the prostitutes arrive with the crown of Uther, which Arthur accepts, holding the sword aloft.
Ah, a tear comes to my eye.
Good lord. You know, it seems even crazier, yet also strangely simpler when taken out of the context of what we actually see in the movie.
Yeah, I knew this, obviously, because we watched it twice within a week, I think, also.
Yeah.
And it's not a topic I'd written down, but I kind of want to address it also in a moment, is just how fucking garbage the story is and how, like, meandering and bizarre it is and how it's just...
It's too... I mean, you could have done a King Arthur thing in a movie and you wouldn't have been able to tell the whole thing, but you could have told
maybe
a piece of it.
You could have distilled it down to a narrative.
You could have told a piece of the King Arthur cycle, but... This movie adds some stuff and covers sort of, like, the territory of more than one piece of it in ways that, like, you never would have had enough time to do this.
It's haphazard, and what I find strange is the plot itself, especially when you hear it read in that synopsis, is very simple.
Yeah.
But the way it gets from beat to beat, like you were saying, takes forever. And then because they are starting the movie when Arthur is very young...
30?
No. When he's, like, five...
Yeah.
The time, you have to compress this massive amount of time in the movie.
The thing
is
if you're telling the story of Arthur pulling the sword out of the stone and realizing he's the King of England, I don't give a shit about Uther or Vortigern. They were ages ago.
Yeah.
Like, the movie starts with Arthur as a young man.
But you know what you definitely care about? The Darklands.
Yeah.
The Darklands.
You could also argue that if you're doing a movie in which Arthur pulls a sword out of the stone, that is your movie.
Yeah.
There is enough there to be a movie. As has been witnessed in the past, it has been a movie.
Also... when it was mentioned in there that he fights Vortigern, Jesus, in another dimension, I did not pick up on that.
I mean, I thought it could have been. I didn't know what it was. Like, they're clearly somewhere else.
Oh, I mean, there was water around them, and
they
climbed a tower, and then there was water around
them.
But I guess there was no scene of, like, okay, now we're in another dimension.
Well, it was the same thing with the Darklands.
Yeah, he
touched
his sword to the altar, and then,
like, it's, again, it's this supernatural bullshit this movie is dripping with. But what I was saying for the story is just, like, you have Arthur gets hassled by Roose Bolton in the beginning, and they have that whole fucking flashback to the Vikings, and then he goes to bed, and then he wakes up, and his friend tells him that they're burning down.
Yeah,
you gotta get out of here. And then he gets kidnapped by a bunch of guys and thrown on a boat and taken to the sword.
Unrelated reasons.
Why doesn't Roose Bolton just show up and be like, hey, you've been dicking around for far too long. I see you haven't grabbed the sword out of the stone yet. Get on this fucking boat and pull the sword out of the stone.
Which goes to the problem of the whole taking the sword out of the stone moment feels so out of nowhere.
Well, I mean, it's not even that. It's just that, like, you could do this in such a linear fashion, but the movie is like, and then we did this, and then we did this, and then this guy showed up, and then this, but now we have to go back to this thing.
I mean, then do we just want to, like, get into this
well,
being Guy Ritchie?
What I want to get into first real quick is just the concept of Arthurian legend to begin with. Like, how much background do you guys have with Arthurian legends at all? If any.
Fair amount. I mean, I read, like, the Arthurian cycle, I think in middle school, and I definitely saw the Sam Neill Merlin made-for-TV movie.
So you've seen the definitive canonical...
The definitive canonical version of the
presentation of King Arthur, yes, okay.
With beautiful CG. And I've seen bits and bobs. Like, I mean, I've read them. I don't know that I was ever,
like what is them, though? I'm curious what you're them.
Yeah, there's, like, there's not, like one... Yeah, were you reading, like, Bardic fucking scrolls, or, like... Like, what...
I've existed a
lot. A lot
of
authors have novelized
the
cycle.
Because, like, the thing... Like, you have Thomas Malory doing Le Mort d'Arthur, like, which is, like, the first time someone really sat down and was like, here's all these stories.
We read a translation of that in middle school, and I think it was sort of, like, the translation for middle schoolers was basically what it was.
Yeah. Some dumbed down, you know.
Yeah.
Let's not use the complicated words in this one.
And then...
I had a bunch of books like that.
What
that
was
no
sex. And then... What was the other one that everyone was kind of reading in high school?
We were.
It's the one where it was mostly just, it was like a...
Just so the stone-based one?
Once in Future King?
Yes, Once in Future King.
Okay.
I read that one too, but I didn't have it for class. I just saw other kids around me reading it. And I was like, that sounds neat. So I found it at the library.
Okay.
And then, I mean, I picked up Associated Media. Like, there was a book I really liked when I was younger. I think it was just called Young Merlin, but it told like a completely not Arthurian related story. But it was kind of cool. So I was never, like, super deep immersed into it, but I have a familiarity with the stories.
Yeah. I have a pretty, not deep, but, like, I was really into it as a kid. I think probably the Sword in the Stone Disney's got me onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys may know this as my friends, that when I am interested in something, I sort of dive 250% into it.
That
and,
is
like,
true.
Do all the work. And so, like, from there, I was like, I gotta get more Merlin.
gotta get me that Merlin.
And more Arthur. And so, like, I looked at what our authors have done. So I definitely read the Once in Future King. My favorite iteration that I've read was the Pendragon Cycle by Stephen R. Lawhead.
Mm-hmm.
And that one mixes a lot of, like, somewhat historical context with a lot of other ridiculous fantasy bullshit. Like, the fact that in that version, Merlin's mother, the Lady of the Lake, is from Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
And people from Atlantis live a lot longer. And so that sort of uses that to explain why Merlin... sort of is
like functionally immortal.
Still younger. Yeah. Like, he's older for Arthur to, like, raise him and counsel him, but he's still not, like, an old man by that time. It lets him do a lot more stuff. So there's still magic involved in it, but, like, the spellings are all very, like Welsh and Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Bedivere is spelt, like, Bedyr. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's Saxons is spelled Sacsens. It was very hard to, like, to understand. Yeah, that's how I thought Saxon was spelt for a long time. Because that was the first time I'd read that word.
It's the most roundabout spelling ever.
Yeah, but it was good. I'd recommend them to anyone who's, like, interested in, like, fantasy, like, novels in general. Because they are sort of, like, high fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But wants to get a decent picture of, like, the full Arthurian cycle. Mm. That's a good version of it. And, yeah, I would, like, do a little bit of research here and there. So I know a little bit about... I don't know. I wouldn't say that I have, like, know a whole lot about the actual true roots of it, because I think a lot of the stuff I read is, like, once or twice removed right. from that. But I'm hugely into so I'm familiar with a lot of the basic concepts that appear in many iterations of the legend.
I mean, I had also done the Once and Future King stories, so, you know, as the rest of you, we have that common background mm-hmm. between us. The other thing that I was familiar with, because my dad had it when I was little, was John Steinbeck had done a translation of the Mallory.
Yeah.
Okay. He died before he finished it, so it's only like 70% of what Mallory did, but it's a decent chunk of it, and it was designed more, I think, for like a contemporary audience and a younger audience than, you know, what you might get if you tried to read anything quite that old.
As in the language was more.
Yeah, it's modern. It's modern English, so like it's easy to read, and so. That's what my familiarity is mostly, aside from like the Sword and the Stone. Also,
yeah.
That would be a lot more accessible.
Did anyone see the movie Excalibur, the X-rated film?
Oh yeah,
it was X-rated.
Topless Helen Mirren.
Yeah,
I never saw it.
Yeah,
there's like some sex in it. But,
yeah,
like,
but
it's not X-rated really.
Well, no, but it's just like it's because it's back at that time when like X-rated was a thing you could do.
When I mentioned that we were thinking about doing this movie to Christian, he was like, "Oh, can't believe you guys aren't doing Excalibur!" Like he's like, "That movie is terrible." So, maybe I'll see it eventually. Is it fun?
I have the DVD,
sort of like, what's that word when you, like, flowery? Not like, I don't know.
Florid?
Florid, I think, is a good word for that movie. It sort of reminds me of the Dracula version that we did for this podcast.
Interesting. I'm in.
Well, it's not quite as, I would say, like,
stylistic.
Campy.
Yeah, it's not really campy, but it is very, like... I mean, it's not...
It's very, like, dense. Visually
it's,
dense.
It's dense. I would say it's narratively dense, too.
Yeah, oh yeah, because they're trying to cover so fucking
yeah,
much.
Yeah, and you don't
like,
really feel
hours.
Attached to the characters
right.
or get a sense of an emotion.
Yeah,
it's like
I know what that's like.
Yeah, it's like watching the Cliff Notes of Arthur and the Round Table.
Sure.
Because the author...
It is like a Merchant Ivory look to it,
yeah.
isn't it? Like...
Well, the author slash director, I might be fucking that up, was John Borman, who was originally attached mm-hmm. to do the animated version of Lord of the Rings. And then he did Excalibur. So see, guys, Oof. Everything ties together. All right, I was just curious we were all coming at this from, like, a perspective of what we knew about King Arthur or what, like, baggage we had.
But I could also just point out then, in light of that baggage, which I would say is pretty light just in terms of, I think we're all open to different interpretations and
directions. Oh, I mean, I love that miniseries with Sam Neill.
It's great!
It's so bad, but it's really good.
Yeah.
Like,
no, I mean, it's not quality, but it's very enjoyable.
There's so much dumb bullshit in that, like the king of the queen of the fairies being a thing, and like,
yeah.
But I love it. I love that.
Yeah.
And I love Merlin, and I love to see things.
The Lady of Lake says, "I'm the Lady of Lake, I'm made of water." And...
She literally says that. I clicked it. Like the first thing I did, I found that yesterday. I went to a random point. It was mm-hmm. the Lady of the Lake going, "But I'm the Lady of the Lake. I'm made of water, and everything is flowing away." And that was
like
the line.
It's so tough because it feels like someone just wrote that as like a almost like a logline description of the character. Like, yeah, she's made of water. And she feels like time is slipping away from her. And they're like, that's a line. We gotta do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the point is, I don't think any of us went into this being like, an Arthur story must be
No, I mean, it's the same thing as Robin Hood, right? Where there's not really, like, a canonical story for this. There are things that you know. Like, there are, like, you know, there's pulling a sword from the stone. There's the Lady of the Lake giving you a sword. Like, there are these elements to Arthurian legend you can pick up on. But it's not like you can look at, like, one definitive text and be like, why, yes, this is the source of it all. It has to be this.
Right.
And so when you have something that's, like, a folklore character like this, then you have to be open to the idea of different interpretations.
Yeah.
That said, perhaps we were not quite expecting this.
No.
I mean, well, to be fair, maybe we were expecting this because we heard that Guy Ritchie was directing
the movie. No, I'm sorry. I never expected a Guy Ritchie film to have giant mammoths.
Oh, that's my God. True. Giant, and I believe I had just gotten home from work. I was pretty out of it. I think I sat down when you guys had this movie on. You guys had just put the movie on. And the first shot is this huge. And when I say huge, I mean, you're seeing this foot. And it is, like, 10 times the size of a man standing on the ground.
It's, like, as big as the castle.
It's like this huge mammoth comes
It's just an elephant, let's be clear also. It's not even a mammoth. It's a straight-up elephant.
Well, but I say out loud, like, so are we just doing, like, dinosaur elephants now?
Well, it's just like the Oliphants from Return of the King. Yeah. Like, it's like Guy Ritchie saw Return of the King. It's like, yep, there it is. Also, to clarify the scale of these things, there's, like, an entire miniature house
on
the back of, like,
there's a pyramid.
Mordred is, like, inside this enormous structure. Yeah. Like, it's big enough to have him and a small army, and he's doing some sort of, like, ritual inside there. So, like, make no mistake, this is a very big elephant.
It was so fucking funny, too.
I'm saying that Camelot was as big as that elephant.
Because I think what I said right before you guys started the movie was like, so this one tries to, like, place it in, like, a real historical context, right? And then, we get opening title crawl of the war between man and mage, and I was like, oh, never mind. And then giant elephant, and I was like, okay, I'm eating my words, I get it.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the style of this movie.
Here's the thing.
Yes.
I mean, where do we even start? It's
with Guy Ritchie.
We start with Guy Ritchie, and I think the umbrella point here is that Guy Ritchie was the wrong director for this.
Yeah.
Because Guy Ritchie makes a Guy Ritchie movie. He makes a
small-time crook.
Salty small-time crook movie where there's a lot of quick editing, a lot of back and forth.
There's heists involved usually.
Yeah. He's good at capers. He's good at fast talking criminals.
Coffee banter.
Yeah. Underworld.
And he bends the Arthurian myth over backwards, practically breaking its back to make Arthur this, like, as it says in the Wikipedia thing, he's like this criminal man of the streets.
He's basically like a racketeer.
Yeah.
And they have to make him a racketeer so that they have a reason for Guy Ritchie to do these, like, bizarre sort of, like, montage stories.
Guy Ritchie sequences.
Yeah, where people, like, lads are all bantering and talking about the day they've had. And, like, what capers they've been up to.
Yeah.
There is one, and the Guy Ritchiness works in some places and doesn't in others. It works when we get that planning VO/montage interspersed with the montage of them finding ways to fuck up Vortigern's kingdom.
Yeah.
That sort of works.
Like, well, here's what we're going to do. And then you see it, and then they're like, oh, that was fun, or whatever.
Yeah.
But then that whole sequence when
the one at the beginning we need to talk about
Bruce
Bolton
kicks the door down and he's like, we gotta talk. And so he, like, drags him into the back room.
And we don't know why.
Yeah.
Why do they have to talk?
No, because we have not really seen Arthur do much of anything yet.
No, he's woken up and talked to someone.
Well, no, he's woken up and he's run in place. And screamed a lot.
It's screaming, he's running, but it's also like this weird, like, shadow boxing.
Yeah.
And it's so weird because you're like, who does that?
Looks like he's having an apoplectic, like a fit. Like a bit of epilepsy. Yeah.
Or like he wakes up and the first thing he feels is rage and he's gotta get it out, man.
Yeah, he's just gotta go,
he's an angry lad.
Punch.
Well, actually, let's step one step further. Our bridge from the crazy magic elephant siege scene
to Arthur being a racketeer is a montage.
Is this breakneck montage covering his growing up.
With my first of my favorite bit of music. It's okay. The music in this movie,
a lot of breath work.
What really pushed me to actually, like, decide I was gonna sit down and watch it was hearing that the soundtrack was like hurdy-gurdy mixed with vocal samplings in a techno style soundtrack, and I was like, what the fuck does that sound like? Turns out
it's pretty good.
Sounds pretty fun.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's this like break. It's like a very like fast paced like.
But then it'll, like, kind of go into this, like, driving guitar, like...
Yeah. It's a hurdy-gurdy.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah,
I enjoy it.
But it's a cool bit of music, but it plays over Arthur getting the shit kicked out of him as a boy teenager.
But,
yeah.
But then it's like every third
shot is like
Vortigern flick to him.
Yeah,
no.
But then every fifth shot is Vortigern like doing a Nazi salute or whatever.
Yeah,
like
preening. Yeah. The biggest problem in the beginning for that sequence is that we have no idea what the context is of any of this. We don't know at first, like, why people are throwing coins at him.
Mm-hmm. No.
Why is he getting into fights? Who are these other people he's with?
Yeah, I was trying to parse it. I was like, is he working for Kung Fu George?
Yeah.
Or is Kung Fu George teaching him? I don't know.
And also, for the first time we watched this, I could have sworn that this was like, so this is a combination brothel and fight school? Because they seem to exist
in
the same
space.
They
do, yeah.
Like, maybe the fight school is in, like, the little outdoor courtyard or something.
Yeah, it's like it's in the backyard or something.
I thought it was, like, a bathhouse or something.
Because
yeah.
Oh, I did too, honestly.
It looks like an old Roman bathhouse
that
got converted. But, because it's like he walks around the corner to it, so I was like, oh, okay. But then the other thing that was weird is several times in that growing up montage, maybe it was two or three, is you see the prostitute... Emily getting smacked around by
getting
someone.
Smacked around the first time he's too young to do anything about
it.
But I was unsure. A,
wait,
was
I'm
the
sorry.
Same guy
was that
like,
his mom?
It's sort
like
of
his
the,
adopted
it's
mom.
It's the one who raised him.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Lily is her name.
Right. No. Yeah. I'm sorry. I know that's not his for real mom. But
yeah.
Like his adopted mom.
But Lily's the one who's like I guess he considers to be his mom.
Okay. But then she like dies in the montage.
Yeah. They
yes.
kill. They
she
kill her
in a later
first.
Montage.
Okay.
She dies in a later montage. But
she doesn't die. To be fair. Of the movie. She doesn't actually die in a montage. She dies and he cries about it and then it cuts forward.
Oh, real mom?
Yeah.
Real mom?
No, real mom doesn't die in a montage, nor does fake mom.
I thought fake mom died.
I don't remember where fake mom dies.
Fake mom
died in the montage when he's like, they killed the whole neighborhood and...
No, there's a scene right before Arthur's gonna be executed in public where Vortigern shows
right.
him like,
oh,
I've got all your prostitute
okay,
friends,
okay.
I'm gonna kill one now, and now if you don't die for me, I'm gonna kill the rest of them.
Okay, and that was her?
That
yes.
Was her.
I
oh,
honestly...
I did not realize
I, okay.
It.
It's a point we'll come back to later. The interchangeable women in this movie.
Yep.
I could not keep
it's
them straight.
Crazy.
Anyway, I'm sorry. So going back to the
so
concept of montages.
I wasn't
movie.
Sure if it was a boyfriend, but then I realized on the second watching, I think it's a Viking. And I think that's what's setting up this
I mean,
moment.
I just thought it was a series of random
it's,
guys.
No, they're different guys every time.
Yeah.
No, I know, but I think it's a Viking each time.
I
no.
didn't think that.
No?
I think it's just that there's a bunch of like jerk guys who keep,
oh,
you know,
fucking
around.
Yeah.
Well, so then, that, honestly, the middle part of that montage where you see what I guess is supposed to be like 15, 16-year-old Arthur, I was like, we should stop there. Because casting Charlie Hunnam in this role is very confusing because he is 30 and it's unclear how old Arthur is supposed to be at the end of this montage. So then he's now...
If he's 30, that means, 25 years have passed since, the... first scene, and Aidan Gillen is still in fighting state.
Well, everyone has only gotten a few wrinkles on their face.
Yeah. How much should Jude Law by that standard?
No, it should be easy to kick his ass.
I know, right? He's gonna die of natural causes in a week or two.
But so that I really wish they had just stuck with that younger actor.
So I don't think we established also really quickly which actors played who real quick. So Jude Law was
Vortigern.
Yeah.
Charlie Hunnam is
Arthur. Aidan Gillen is
Goose That Bill. So,
yeah.
Aidan Gillen, Digimon Hansu are the two people who used to be Uther's knights that
right.
are now members of the Resistance.
Right.
And then his sort of newer, his Arthur's lads.
Yes.
I don't know any
I don't
of
know
them.
The actors,
they're all
so,
character
yeah.
actors.
Just, yeah.
Backlack and Wetstick. And also Kung Fu George.
And also Kung Fu George, yeah.
Awesome, not great.
Yeah.
So then that's the first montage, but then
right.
we very quickly get into the second one.
Well,
when Bruce Bolton kicks in the door and he's like, we gotta talk, drags them, I guess, go into this back room, and then what should be a story.
Oh, this is
story,
the most confounding,
here's the thing.
Infuriating thing I've
it
ever had to sit
felt
through.
Like Guy Ritchie was like, you know, guys, this is gonna be really tough, but I know our editing team can pull it off. It's
I don't know. I think Guy Ritchie thought he was doing something very fun and clever.
No, I think he did. I think Guy Ritchie thought this is my wheelhouse. I can do this so perfectly. Watch me do it. This
honestly,
is a great indication of how the movie is going to go.
It's so fucking confusing because you start on one thread and he was like, no, back up. I want you to start here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you physically back up into that. And then he was like, are you sure you didn't meet anyone else? Oh, we did. Let's go back to this earlier point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it bounces around in time. And, the first time we watched it, I had to stop it and be like, first of all, you went to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And Chris and I got halfway through this. And I was like, Brendan cannot miss this.
Well, he can't miss it because they get into this exchange where they mention oh, yeah, the boy was doing some graffiti. And he was like, what boy?
What
boy? Blue
boy.
Great
boy.
Good boy.
He's a good boy.
And it was like, you need to pause. Brendan has to
see this. Basically, the way that because there's three fucking dudes trying to tell the same fucking
right.
story. And so they, one person, they speak nearly over each other. And then King Arthur keeps doing this thing where he keeps, razzing
Bruce Bolton. Yeah. Like, oh, you're giving me a headache. Yeah, like, yeah.
Which is honestly a reflection of
you can't keep your questions in a straight line. Yeah. I'm trying to tell a story. I'm like, no, you're fucking saying nothing at all. Yeah. Like,
and so, okay, so then, so the two major takeaways from this. One, there was no reason to do it in this fashion as opposed to just doing it in a standard linear fashion. And two, nothing is gained from this in the first place, narrative-wise.
No.
You meet Vikings. The Vikings have so little to do with the plot.
The end result of this montage is finding out that people want to kill King Arthur. Not King Arthur.
King Vardigan.
No.
No?
Yeah, the end result of this montage is that people are out to get Arthur because he has attacked people close to
King's protection. Yeah, right. That's right, because the Vikings are...
Yeah,
are
all you really need to establish is that Arthur's a wanted man because he attacked the wrong person.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it took us 10 minutes.
It's a long and winding road to get there. Yeah. And listen, I'm sure sometimes it's obnoxious to hear three people try to tell the same story, replete with interjections. Yeah. We do that all the time. Well, and I'm sure, you know, it can be annoying to hear, like, three different people try to tell the same story, and there's tons of interjections, and it's kind of hard to follow. But we are three people talking in real time, and this is all being recorded. We are not working with a script. And this was not written with the idea to be clever and fun.
Yeah.
We are not sitting here trying to give you a narrative that you have to take away to understand the media that you're taking in. We are just three people talking into a mic.
We don't have someone as talented as Mr. Ritchie directing us.
Yeah,
it's just so bananas to me that
we'll have our
he made this choice and that no one thought, like, huh, no one
this is confusing.
What the fuck
yeah.
is going
the
on.
Script supervisor that was just sleeping. Nah, that sounds fine. To your point, I think you brought this up initially, Brendan. I hadn't considered it, but, like, the main piece of information you get, as we said, is that, you know, the king now wants the what were they called? The Blacklegs?
The Blacklegs.
The Blacklegs want Arthur because he attacks someone under the king's protection.
Yeah.
But also, it turns out they want him anyway because they haven't found out if he can pull the fucking sword out yet. So it doesn't fucking matter that he attacked the wrong
None
people.
Of that mattered. He could have just been walking down the street, been accosted by a Blackleg, and they had said, hey, you don't have a brand? Get on this fucking boat.
So I wonder if that was a thing that you mentioned, Brendan, they wanted to make this movie for a long time, and I wonder if that was a relic of, like, an older version of the script.
I honestly, I'm not sure. Like, I mean,
it is
like a Frankenstein's monster of a script. Like, there are so many different elements just thrown against the wall like spaghetti to see. Stick.
By the way, if you didn't have the Blacklegs abducting people to go pull the sword out of the stone bit, you could use the Viking incident as your into the Arthur versus Vortigern
thing. We could play a fun game about what we think individual pieces of stories were.
A fun game? You think that would be a fun one?
No, I mean, I think it's pretty easy to tell, like, what Guy Ritchie came up with.
Yeah.
I think that's clearly, like, Arthur being a racketeer or a small-time criminal. Mm-hmm. I think that it potentially, the idea that, like, we're branding people to find out if they're the king or not,
mm-hmm.
or the born king, is a separate idea that maybe we kept over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where this video game concept of, like, humans versus mages came from, but that is clearly not something Guy Ritchie came up with.
I think there's also, going forward to a later montage that we see in this movie, Lee's favorite sequence on the movie, the Darklands sequence.
Okay, first of all, we can all agree, it's a fucking stupid name for anything. The Darklands.
Oh, it's the dumbest, like, thing. But then I was confused. I think Arthur was, too, because they, like, go to an island and, like, he's like, is that it? He's like, no, that's the entrance. And then there's some sort of, like,
Stonehenge, and there's, like, a ring of sand that
it's
the
like
mage
it's basically,
and
like, a Celtic spirit quest, right? Like, where he goes to some fairy
realm. But
then
that's cut up, too, where there's clearly, like, three different threads happening, and one is getting picked up by this giant prehistoric bat.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is fighting off rats in what looks like this weird river valley.
And then there's, like, a mountain top.
And then there's,
like,
a mountaintop with these giant glowing-eyed wolves advancing on him in the movie.
Yeah,
and not only that, so the other thing is, much like the earlier montages, you're also cutting in between Bedivere and the mage, talking about what he will be doing.
What he will be doing or has done.
Yes, and so, again, also, fucks with your timeline, because he is doing it, but they're talking about what he will be doing, or are they saying it in the past tense and this is what he is doing?
Yeah.
I don't know.
They could be talking about it while he's there in real time, or it could be after he's sent them there, or it could be before they've even talked about something in there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And you also gain fucking nothing.
Right, and here's the thing, too.
From it.
I would not have known precisely what was happening had they not explained it to me in that montage.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing. I don't want to see... So, I don't really care about training sequences in movies like this.
Yeah.
I don't care to see King Arthur go to the Darklands and fight some bats and shit and then come back a better person. But the mage straight up says, like, he has to go there and he has to be broken down and then he'll come back and he'll do what he has to do. Had she not said that, you would have no fucking clue as to what it was he was doing there.
And do you know what
sequence.
The end, once again, the ultimate thing they needed to get across there is he needed to get a vision of
what happened when he was 5 years old, yeah, and he watched his father
which
die.
He's also had in dreams.
Yeah,
so, like,
he's had it, but he's like rejected. So the idea is that he, when he touches the sword, he sees this memory that he's tried to suppress all of his life, mm-hmm, and he keeps rejecting it, and that's why he can't unlock the sword's potential. And so she's like, well, I guess for some reason in the Darklands, he's not going to be able to reject it or something, and so we're going to make you go there and yeah, touch the sword to the stone, and that's going to make you have the full vision.
Yeah.
But that still isn't it. Because
right, no, because he still doesn't really want to touch the sword with both hands, no, which yeah, is important. You have to touch the sword with both hands.
You do, because he wields it with one hand, and his eyes are normal, and there's not this weird, like, blue, unpassable.
Well, everyone and their mom is telling him to hold it
with both hands. Hold it with both hands, please. The mage does. Everyone's yeah, like, with both hands, please.
Yeah.
okay, so... there's one montage that does work, and that was, we kind of mentioned it before, where they're like talking about their plans to fuck up Vortigern's shit, and that's entertaining and that's well done. But for me, the rest of those montages, the Darklands, the growing up, which one am I missing now? The stupid story.
Oh God, yeah.
All of that makes it feel as if nothing is happening in the movie for me.
Well, it feels like the movie is spinning its wheels.
Yes.
It is. I mean, it's simultaneously not going anywhere and going to too many places.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel like there's not enough going on. And I was like, so you had no plot, so we're just going to sit here and we're going to go in like 5,000 different little tangents for like a hot second, and then we're going to get back onto the plot.
Right, and then, well, no, it's just, and then we're going to end up exactly where we were from the
yeah,
beginning.
Yeah.
So like, we haven't gone anywhere, but we've gone everywhere.
Which was,
you know?
Which was frustrating, because I do feel like the growing up thing could have been something you could have used. The Darklands could have been something you could have used. You know what mm-hmm, I mean? I actually think the whole scene with the Vikings and the furs guy that they're extorting money from, all of that could have been a way to let you in on the character somewhat, or at least be like, this is what his life is. But it doesn't, not really.
Here's the thing. Had you cut every montage from this movie except for the one with the plan, nothing would have been affected.
No, yeah, not really.
True.
Like,
there are minor bits of...
Yeah, there are minor things that, like, a character would have to say
yeah,
something to cover, but, like, there's so little that you would have lost had you asked that.
Here's a question I want to pose to you guys. The Guy Ritchie-ness of this, the small criminal, sassy backtalk kind of shit,
mm-hmm,
is that even well done in this movie?
Yeah.
Do you think the Guy Ritchie-ness is good?
Like, I don't think it's the best.
I think it's what... It's your mileage may vary.
Yeah.
Yeah,
with what you
true,
get.
Did
yeah,
you like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking
yeah,
Barrels? Or
yeah, I think it's like... I looked up the actor that played Bruce Bolton. I was like, has he been in a Guy Ritchie movie before? He's like really...
He gets it.
Yeah.
Really nailed it.
Yeah.
No, I think it's like on par with the usual sort of like bunch of lads talking.
Yeah. No. Yeah, like you said, exactly. Like, if you like Guy Ritchie, you'll probably like what he does here. If you don't, then
yeah,
you will just be, like, furious this entire time.
Basically, yeah.
Or, I mean, like, I like Guy Ritchie movies well enough, but I was never... I mean, I felt like it was fine, but it just sort of fell out of place.
It's also weird, too, because, like, Digimon Hanzo and Aiden Gillen are in a different movie. They're not in a Guy Ritchie movie.
That's
now,
true.
They
yeah,
talk in very, like, practiced ways,
yeah,
whereas, like, all of his lads are, like... We're poetic and rhymy
yeah,
and like
yeah,
and
yeah,
fast talking.
Yeah.
Like Aiden Gillen and Digimon Hanzo just speak normally.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, like everyone aside from the lads does that. Like
pretty much.
It's really
yeah,
just like if
Jude Law does
yeah,
something.
Yeah, no, like I mean like the lads are really the ones
yeah,
who are beamed from another.
Jude
place.
Law gets a lot of really florid lines about like
he gets
yeah,
florid lines, but he also
when
just,
they fear you, that you feel most alive.
Yeah.
Right.
Like whatever
but
he says.
Also, I just feel like there were moments where Jude Law wasn't given much to do, so he was like, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna pour just like something into this. Because there's that moment where it's just that shot of him, like, with his hand out at the people, and he's just sort of like this.
Yeah, he's making them all
the,
out.
Wait, like, what? Do it again
for
our listeners?
For the people who are listening.
Yeah.
He sort of sticks his hand out almost as if he's presenting something. I guess he's presenting himself, but it's sort of like, and he sort of sweeps his hand across the people.
But then he moves it back, and
yeah,
he makes them bow as they, and at first I couldn't tell. I actually thought
did
he
you
was
magic?
Yes.
Okay, I did too.
Well, me too.
I thought he was forcing them to bow.
Yes, alright.
Which was kind of interesting, right?
Which, okay, so maybe this is a good segue to characters in general. We can start with Jude Law. What?
Well, I was going to say, do we want to get into the visual style, or is that separate?
What do you have to
I
say?
Wanted to talk about what I liked about the stylistic choices.
Yeah.
All right, so before we move on to characters then, what do you want to talk about with style and visuals and that
so
sort of
what I want to, like, beyond the fact that, like, the sort of narrative style applied is awful for this plot.
Yeah.
Visually, I think there's a lot of really cool shit in this movie.
Too.
I'm not impressed with the Darklands and the rats and the giant bats.
Yeah, fuck that.
What I am really impressed with, in general, and, like, I don't know that it belongs in an Arthur movie or that I wanted this movie to be a King Arthur movie, but, like, I think it's, like... Like, this is, like, the best video game adaptation of a video game that doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah,
there were
true,
so many moments where Lee and I were just sort of, like, Dark Souls. Or,
yeah,
What was the other one we were name checking? Or it's, it also sort of feels like there's a D&D campaign sometimes.
The first scene literally mirrors a scene in Shadow of the Colossus where Uther is on a horse and he dives it off a cliff. Like, he has to sacrifice his horse to jump onto this giant beast that he has to climb and then get inside to kill. But, like, we were saying that, like, we're the first time I watched it, we're like, this is the prologue to a video game where you get to play as the overpowered character.
Yeah. And then, it gives you the taste of all the flashy moves and stuff.
Yeah, look at all these cool power moves you can do with Excalibur, and then it gets taken away from you.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's like this really cool sequence in so there's two sequences towards the end where he's storming the castle with Excalibur trying to get Vortigern. The first one is him with a bunch of knights that he's just like murdering his way through.
Within like this... Well, which one are you talking about?
It's where he's.
Gates, and it's, yes. It looks like a quick time.
It's event. Nighttime, and it looks quick time event. Like bullet sword time, and he's like, it's dark, but he's very smooth in his motions,
right.
Very smooth.
It's following him.
It's almost like the camera's moving around.
Yeah,
him.
Yes. Like, it's like he is moving, but the camera's focused entirely on him.
Yeah,
it's like the background is moving to come to him.
Yeah,
but doesn't it also seem like his image would be in like almost snap into relief every time he would hit like a power pose?
Yeah.
Too?
Yes.
Like it was almost very comic book.
It would
way.
It would zoom, stop, zoom, stop. And it was like that moment in a video game where it's like you're on
press
your
square.
It's doing all this cool movement so that all you're really doing is hitting a button at the right time and you get to watch yourself do this really cool thing.
And it was enjoyable. And yeah, and then I think the other thing we both kind of agreed on was when it's Demon Knight Vortigern.
Yeah.
And like
it's literally
dimension.
Like a Dark Souls boss.
Well, because and it's very Dark Souls looking, where it's this very on the nose.
Yeah, it's frankly not a very inspired look for a villain.
But this, like, smoldering, firing smoke and ash cape, which I thought was kind of cool looking.
Yeah.
So I liked that, and I liked the brief sequence where one of Arthur's many, many flashbacks to his father dying, where you see Vortigern, and he looks a little CGI, like he kind of has the coat on, he's a little gray or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Had it been more of that, I would have been okay with it. I'm not wild about the goofy, like, CGI horn thing.
He almost looks Wraith-like.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was cool.
Because you still get Jude Law there without it just being, like, a bunch of pixels.
And
I agree that it takes the emotion out of it, because it's just now he's just, like, a weird creature.
Monster.
A soulless demon thing.
But his weapon is even this, like, ridiculous double-sided scythe.
Yeah.
But then there was moments, like, he basically floors Arthur with, like, a fireball, and it literally is like, I didn't know how to counter that.
Then he does it later, you're like, shoop!
Well, because he's... Well, he goes down for the count, and that's where he gets his tutorial to counter the fireball. The other visual bit I was really... Well, two visual bits I was really digging. I loved the look of the giant elephant, the demon elephant with the crazy ziggurat on its back. I mean, there was something crazy over the top about it.
It's an insane thing to start your King Arthur movie on. But it was cool looking.
Which is why it ultimately felt like Dark Souls, because it did feel like, oh, this is what Asia thinks... like a medieval culture fantasy is going to be. But then also, I loved the look of the moat hags, as they're called. They're like these squid-like women.
Ursula the Sea Witch and her two sexy daughters.
But they're not... I don't find them to be sexy.
I mean, I'm not saying that I want to fuck them, Chris. I'm saying they're sexualized.
I guess I was expecting them to be more sexualized, so I was like, wow.
I mean, they were topless, like, skinny women.
That's true. And
maybe
I guess
it's
they were
just sort
of too
gay to respond to it, Chris.
Probably.
We'll have to ask Mike.
A straight man?
Yeah. Let's call a straight man. Phone a straight man on the phone.
Is Mike going to be our straight man on text?
I just remember Mike being a touch point for Dracula and finding one of the Dracula wives sexy.
Yeah,
and I was like, that was news to me.
Monica Bellucci.
Yeah.
Returning guest actress.
So I would agree. They were unsettling because the, like, it's weird. Even when the younger ones were swimming around, they're like, some of them were tentacles and some of them were skin, and you couldn't really tell where the tentacles ended and the skin
began.
Right,
but like the first initial shot where like they wash up on shore, basically.
It was really
upsetting. It's like you just see like the large Ursula-esque one, and then you notice that there are like two other ones.
Well, yeah.
And at first you're like, are they attached to each other? And I think they were like suckling her breasts or something.
Yeah.
Were they?
That was my takeaway. I thought they were like her daughters.
Because it's
and they
weird
were suckling
because
her
when
breasts.
They do wash up, it just looks like it's like this massive tentacle.
That's
sort of unfolding.
Yeah.
That part I thought was... And they gave good whisper talk, like that was good and ominous. There are bits that worked. My problem was, I thought, for the most part, the video gaminess was pretty enjoyable. I mean, it was hokey in certain parts. I mean, the look of Vortigern the Demon Knight was very literal. Like, when you think Demon Knight, and I feel like a person was like, horns, skull, fire, brimstone.
Yeah, red eyes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Crazy
but
cape, that's it.
I sort of enjoyed it. Like, it was a very committed look. It felt like it had more spark and, I don't know, just panache than a lot of the movie.
Yeah.
The other visual bit I'm just going to put in here is Jude Law's fab Evil King looks. He looked great. Like, they were ridiculous.
I think the good King looks were also really good. I think Uther was hot to trot.
He was, I mean, Eric Bana is.
Yeah, but like, yeah. The look of Camelot that you get, like, when it's being attacked at the beginning, like, it's still very bright, and like, mm-hmm. everyone's wearing these amazing colors.
Mm-hmm.
And
very then, saturated.
Yeah, and then yeah. Vortigern comes in and makes everyone wear black.
Immediately changes the color scheme of Camelot.
To like, black, all black.
To black. I love that
black
the army,
and gunmetal gray.
The army starts to wear masks and hoods like they're comic, like they're like very literal assassins almost.
Yeah. Nothing's more practical when you're fighting than having a mask on.
Right, yeah. Just only to see out of yeah. slits in your.
Yep.
But yeah, I wanted more of that. That just would have been fun.
So to segue to characters, who do we want to cover first?
Arthur.
Okay. Well, I'm bored. Like, what do you have to say about
me
Arthur?
Too.
Arthur's an adult character.
He's
an
adult
movie.
Character. It's very paint by numbers. This character, like
the problem with Arthur is that. The narrative stylistic failings of this movie, he has no emotional growth in the movie.
Yeah.
His motives are not shown. They're sort of told to you.
Yeah.
And they're not really that great of a motive. Like, his initial motive to go after Vortigern is like, well, he went after my family and the people that I like, so mm-hmm. I want to just kill him. It's not really about, like, reclaiming the throne
yeah.
at all, or, like...
And it doesn't really become that, like, it
really doesn't. There's never a moment where he thinks, like, oh my god, I'm gonna have to be responsible for
yeah.
a kingdom after
yeah.
this.
Because there is a very bizarre moment where, toward the end of the movie, he lobs Excalibur into the lake and, like, runs through the woods screaming, like, rah, no more, no more.
I can't do this.
Yeah. And then the Lady of the Lake pops up from a puddle, grabs him, and gives him the sword back, and she's like, no, you gotta do this shit.
Hold it with both hands.
Yeah, it's gonna be really bad. We should have grabbed both hands. Wink, wink. And... then, like, he immediately, like, thrusts the sword into the air, and he's screaming, and he's like, ah, and you're supposed to be like, oh, yes, like, he's claimed his birthright, but, like, it has been fucking 4 minutes since he said no to the point he said yes again.
Yeah.
Like, what has changed in that time?
It's a real
scene. He saw a spooky
effect.
Future.
Yeah, he saw a spooky future.
Yeah.
But not really. He saw a spooky future where it's, like, three women are, like, holding a dead person, and you're supposed to be like, oh, that's everyone? That's just...
Well, I mean, it was the whole kingdom was on fire.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it is a spooky future, but, like, clearly, he's not supposed to be an idiot, so he should probably be able to deduce this himself, right?
Yeah.
That if a bad king stays a king and becomes magic, things will be very bad for everyone.
Yeah.
Well, and the crazy thing about that, too, to me, was I never really felt like he cared, ever. Like, they put on such a show of him not giving a shit and just being this, like, just sort of dick to people. Like, where he says to, what does he say to Goose Fat Bill, like, oh,
Put your ring back on, honey tits.
Yeah. You haven't had enough porridge this morning yeah. for that.
That's literally what he says to
this. What does
so
that
awful.
Mean? And then, like, he turns around on his horse to, like...
Talk to the mage.
To talk to the mage. That's her only
name. Are you falling for me like I'm falling for you?
And it's just... You're just sort of like, what?
Yeah, like, are you?
Like...
You have said nothing to each other.
Well, and I think what they were trying to sell there was, you know, he's like a rake. But you don't get that. I feel like they were going for a character angle with him that was never quite realized, and I just never found him charming or fun. He's just sort of boring, dull. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, he's... I don't know. It's just... I wish that they'd done something with his character, but they really didn't.
Yeah. So, want to go to Vortigern?
Yeah, I think I basically summed
problem?
Up as, like, they should have made a choice to have him be a two-dimensional villain that we don't give a shit about, and it's mm-hmm. just, like a cackling, insane person.
Yeah.
Or you needed to do a better job of making him a little bit more relatable or understandable from how he got from point A to evil villain.
Right. Well, so there's, well, just in the beginning, real quick, whenever Mordred is attacking on his big elephants, there is a weird scene where Arthur goes to kill Mordred,
mm-hmm.
and you see... Vortigern. God, I'm never going to get it right. You see Vortigern, and his nose starts to bleed, and his eyes go
weird.
Yeah,
it looks like he's, like, having a headache.
Yeah.
Like it's like, you actually do see, I think, a shot of Mordred, like, doing a, you know, eyes rolling to the back of his head,
yeah.
and then, like, and then you see Vortigern going, like, oh, like, an ear pit, like, and there's, like, an ear ringing noise.
Led us all to believe. I do not believe we were... way off base in this one to think that he was doing something to
he was
Mordred.
Influenced in some way
yeah,
by Mordred.
Yeah, we all thought that Mordred was doing something to him in that moment. And
yeah.
then it's sort of revealed later on that, like...
It was the other way around. Vortigern is the one who brought Mordred into this fold.
Not really.
Well, I mean, they both hated each other, but, like, it was just that he didn't do anything to him. They were already in cahoots.
Yeah, they were already
right.
in cahoots by that point. And you're like, what?
And so, like, so then what was all this business about?
Definitely,
and then you also have the sequence shortly after that wherever he's taking his wife down to the cistern thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, all
he's
blah,
like,
blah, blah,
I just gotta do it.
I gotta do it. I have to do the thing. And then he stabs her. And you're supposed to feel bad because he killed his wife. But
and he's ringing a bell and you don't get why until later.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like he's being compelled to do it or whatever. And then, no, it turns out he was told that he could get a lot of power from doing it.
Right. And then, because at the end, he has to do the same to his daughter, but you don't care.
His daughter.
Because he has interacted with her maybe twice in the entire movie.
And was named once, and I think you get exactly two shots of her face in this entire movie.
Yeah.
What is her name? Serena?
Katya.
Katya.
I could not have told you. So it's just, are we supposed to care that he is making these decisions? Are we supposed to not? Like, presumably we are supposed to care that he has killed his wife and his daughter. Like, this is supposed to be a bad thing. And from, like, a viewer perspective, like, sure, it's a bad thing. We know this.
We barely know that she's his wife when he kills her.
Well, I mean, like, you know it's bad because he's killing this woman.
Right.
But, like, you don't care about her.
No.
You don't care about his daughter.
No.
You don't really care about him. And again, we had also said when watching this movie, what is the deal with the business with the moat hags anyway? Like, why are they showing
up
here?
Why are there moat hags?
Yeah, like, where did they come from? How does he know to talk to them?
I guess what they're trying to suggest is they had some sort of pre-existing agreement. I have no fucking idea.
Well, there's the brief sequence before he kills his wife. You see him looking at scrolls, and on one of the scrolls is a bunch of tentacles.
Right.
So, like, I guess he found a scroll that said, like, hey, moat hags are down here.
Or,
ask them for help.
Or was the scroll to summon them, and then now they're just sort of generally in the area? Because he rings that bell to bring them into the cistern.
Right.
I think that's what that was, right?
Right, yeah, that's what he does.
And then he pushes the body out into there.
Yeah,
and they...
yeah, no, every time, like, he wants to summon them, he kind of just rings the bell. But, again, like, if we had said earlier, like, why is it them at all? Why isn't it, like, the ghost of Mordred,
right,
who is, like, you know, like, not dead but not alive and needs, you know, Vortigern's whatever, anything, than these fucking random sirens who have no context in this sequence at all.
Aside from those scenes of him showing remorse, they just seem to be happening to different people, because the Vortigern we see otherwise has no emotion, aside from, I guess, petulance.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really have any moments where he's anything but this very sort of dour villain. So it's weird for him to be like, oh, I feel really bad about killing my daughter. I'm like, I don't think you do. I think you're cool with this, actually.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like you needed her.
No,
much.
He doesn't seem to care about her until the end when he starts crying after he stabs her.
Yeah.
Like, I guess you cared.
Can we use this as a springboard into just female characters in this movie?
Yeah.
There are none.
Yeah.
Well, that's why, to bring it back to the name of the drink, it's less than two women. I would say we have...
The mage is pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if we want to pile all the female characters, I think we come out with one and a half. I think we have the mage, who does not even get a real name, and that bugs the fuck out of me. And then everyone else is sort of half a character.
Maggie is the one that's, like, the spy?
Yes.
Yeah.
So she's established as Katya's companion?
No, Katya has a different companion. Maggie's just there.
Yeah, Maggie,
representative of the people.
Yeah, I don't fucking know.
Okay,
so
she's the member of one of England's
oldest
families.
Yeah, I just, like, a lady in waiting or something.
I guess.
I don't know. But
and so she's only in it for a few scenes, and then she's the mole who tells the rebels what's up. You think she's dead, and I could have sworn she was in the first one, but then you get two shots of her escaping.
Well, right,
because
there's
the
entire sequence where Jude Law's talking to her in a wagon, and he's, like, I forget what the fuck he says to her.
She's saying, like, this is it, this is the, you know, your little rebels are dying, and then she says, but the noose is tightening around your neck.
Yeah, but even before that, like, there's a brief sequence where he, like, says something that's, like, oh, complimentary, and then he's like, but I know that you are a spy, like, you know, some bullshit like that. And, like... if you had watched those two scenes, I think you would be forgiven for thinking that he kills her afterward.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, especially because the times where you see her are very quick cuts of her face.
And
which I completely missed on the first viewing.
Speaking of killing women, there's a lot of that in this movie.
Oh my goodness.
Well, you gotta get rid of both wives in this movie.
You gotta get rid of his mom.
Yep, you gotta get rid of Arthur's mom, and then, you know, apparently Uther, Vertigo's wife had to go because more
times. Magic, yeah.
Well, it really is just, it's the term of women in refrigerators to very quickly define that is the killing or depowering of a female character to give motivation to the male hero, typically.
Right.
And that is pretty much literally what happens with most of the women in this movie. Vortigern's wife and daughter die to further his plot. Arthur's mother dies seemingly just so we can have a flashback about her death. Although, can we just talk for a brief second about how that kid has no reaction to his parents being brutally killed?
The cold-dead eyes of a killer, 5-year-old. Yeah, he doesn't even cry. He doesn't. His facial expression doesn't change.
Dull surprise.
Yeah, and then Arthur's surrogate mother also dies.
Also dies in front of him.
Yeah.
We
don't care that much because he doesn't seem to care.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he has a scream react, but that's
But like, it's not like afterwards he's like, oh, I'm so sad, my mom's dead.
Yeah.
He's like immediately starts like making passes at
the mage.
Yeah.
It's just very frustrating that on the whole, the way that women are treated as if they're a complete afterthought in this movie. They just don't really exist in this world.
Yeah. And so I want to object, not object, but like I want to interject and say that like, yeah, the original King Arthur cycle is a bit of a sausage fest.
Oh, yeah.
Because guess what? Women back then were objects to be won.
Yeah.
I
just want to interject your interjection just real quick. The one thing I had forgotten about when I was doing some cursory research about like the Thomas Malory Arthur and everything like that is that apparently Guinevere would like sit in on the Knights of the Round Table.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she had like, she was an important
actor. Yeah, and, like she would like offer her opinion. So like, you have her. Like,
but the way, what I was going to say is that none of the important women in the Arthurian cycle are in this movie.
Yeah,
no Morgan.
Yeah. There's no Morgan.
No Guinevere.
There's Guinevere.
No Guinevere.
What's her name?
Nimue is not in here, but neither is Merlin. So,
yeah,
like,
so I guess there's that,
I mean, presumably she would have been the villain for the second movie.
Yeah, and then what's her face also? Lady of the Lake is barely in it.
Yeah.
She's in there just so you can see her eyes.
She's in there again to motivate Arthur to do something. Like, her purpose is to make him do things.
And it's frustrating, and you know, we talked about this a little bit, but I feel like in this movie you do have racial diversity without comment. It's just a shame that you couldn't have done the same for
I think what I had said off mic before we started recording is like, yeah, it did occur to Guy Ritchie, and I think it does occur to a lot of people, like, you know, when you're doing things like Hamilton, like, wow, you can put racial diversity and just not talk about it and tell a story that maybe, like, yeah, theoretically, it wouldn't have made sense, like...
Or you're commenting on it.
Without commenting on it.
No, I'm saying, or you're making a point.
Or you're making a point,
Hamilton's
yeah.
more about making a point, yeah. But
anyway. Like, you can do a story, or, like, you know, the idea of recasting Hermione, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And just not talk about it, and let's not make a big deal about it. I don't think it does occur to people in the same way that you could just do that with gender. Like, you can replace fairy tales with, you know, princes that have to be saved.
Yeah.
And you could swap all that out. Really, you're telling the same story, but... I mean, who in this world really ever expected Guy Ritchie to think that? Like,
no, but it's just a bummer because I think, you know, taking Guy Ritchie out of the picture for a moment, that could have been cool to have if
you... It would, yeah. But like, and I'm not forgiving Guy Ritchie. I'm just saying, like, you know, you should have lowered your expectation a long time ago.
Yeah, no, there's no timeline where you expect Guy Ritchie to do that.
That being said, there are things about the character of the mage to appreciate. It does bug me a lot that she's not given a name.
Yeah.
I think that's
I don't think it should bug... Not that it should bug you. I don't think it bugs me. I'm fine with a nameless female character.
There
she's
is
like
also,
mysterious.
To be fair, an earlier version of this where she was
Guinevere.
Yeah.
So. I feel like she was probably going to be Guinevere.
Yeah.
If
like,
the movies had kept going.
We're
going to
hang that up for the sequel.
Yeah.
There are things I like about it. I feel like they could have cast... I feel like they could have given this a different look for her. But I think she had a very interesting look to her. She was very unconventionally beautiful. I thought I was really appreciative that they didn't try to shoehorn in a non-existent romantic, no chemistry relationship with her and Arthur. She seems to be sort of...
Well, Arthur is an absolute pig to her for most of the movie.
Yeah.
But she's, like, not having it. She's not here for any of it. Everything she does in the movie is incredibly useful and good.
Yeah. I mean, I said this when we started watching it for the second time. I was like, she is the most useful member of Arthur's party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's getting shit done left and right.
Yeah.
There is
something. She's what I liked about her, to really quick is that she was sort of like, I don't know, almost like a little bit on the spectrum.
Affected, yeah.
She doesn't look people in the eyes when she talks to them. She doesn't like talking to people at all, it seems. And she really doesn't seem to want to sort of counsel Arthur, but she's doing it because nobody else can, because she's like the mystical go-to for knowledge. And I liked the idea that she was like sort of the expertise. She was like the expert around, but she was, you know, she wasn't really comfortable with like doling out the advice.
It was funny though that like her oddly effective way of getting Arthur out of that like crazy situation of almost being publicly executed was like, well, first I'm gonna make a hawk fly down or an eagle fly down and like harass a guard, and then I'm gonna have the horses move, and then I'm gonna set the dogs like off
and
the chain.
And then I'm gonna get you a headache.
Yeah,
exactly. All of her magic is like very animal based.
Yeah, I mean, going to say though is I'm confused by a lot of what her I don't want to say what her purpose is, but like what she's doing in some sequences, like where they're at when they're at Medieval Fight Club and all the blacklegs are coming in to attack them. She makes a bunch of birds fly around briefly.
I think she's trying to distract the archers.
I guess she is.
She
but
is,
like,
because you can see them reacting, trying to swap.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I expected more. Like,
well, I don't think that, and it does. Again, it doesn't seem like she can do a whole lot.
Yeah.
Because all she does is control animals. So right. In some ways, she can't do a whole lot.
There are some vague rules here about what it is that she can and can't do.
Well, then again, I think I brought this up, though. She summons a giant fucking snake in the end. Yeah. And I'm like, well, why not that? Start there.
Yeah.
And so I talked about how what I don't like about this movie and that I don't really want, like, I hate when books have, like, so many rules around magic.
Me too.
Like, I like it to be mystical and open. However, the one rule of magic you should have is that there should be, like, a cost to it. Because if you can just always summon giant snakes, why aren't you always summoning
just
giant snakes?
Just spamming the world of the giant snakes.
What did it take you to do giant snake that you couldn't have done earlier?
I mean, what I kind of wish is I wish she was the giant snake. Like, because I'm thinking, like, as a more proactive thing for her to do, because then, like, she does the thing, she eats the guards or whatever, and then she's like, I used up all my fucking magic for the next couple of hours, I'm sorry, kid, you're on your own.
Yeah.
And she just has to, like, sit down and take a little rest.
That would have been cool. She does do two other things not animal related, though. That weird, like, when he's passed out...
She makes the potion.
Well, she makes the potion to give him that weird sight, and we kind of go into that kind of cool sequence where he's, like, seeing this, like, extra weird, drugged out layer of things. But then... No, though, I was also thinking of, she does this weird, like, herb and smoke thing around his sword while he's asleep one time, and so that she can grip it without, consequence and look into this memory that he's experiencing.
Yeah.
And that's what leads her to be like, you have to face this shit.
Yeah.
Which I thought was cool. Anywho.
Do you want to go to world building?
It's real. It's England, but also it's an England where there were a lot of mages such that there were a war between...
Yeah.
Humans, quote-unquote, and mages.
Do you suppose this shares DNA with Albion when it was England versus the Giants? From
possibly.
Jack the Giant Slayer?
Yeah, possibly, yeah, right? And then
Albion
then it became the Crown Jewels.
Yeah, except Albion became Londinium, I suppose.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's I don't know. I think this is another consequence of the being a hodgepodge script of many, you know, it's a homunculus of a movie.
Well, and I guess wanting to kind of, they want to do a little bit of history, but they also want to do the myths are real kind of thing.
Yeah. And so some of it I think is cool, but I think, again, I have a big problem with the magic being confusing. And like, what if, okay, so Mordred, you definitely made a deal with Mordred because you said you did, but then why are there sirens and why are you making deals with them also?
Right.
Are they part? Were they? Do they work for Mordred?
Yeah.
Are they separate?
Right.
Are they just a neutral entity?
Well, and the moat hags also, they have a line about how, like, the more your power grows, the more the powers that resist
you. Yeah, what does that mean?
Grow.
Yeah.
Well, that to me indicated, because they deliver that line after the water lowers and like reveals the stone and everything. So I thought when I first watched this, there was gonna be a plot line about nature actually starting to resist Vortigern, which would have been cool, but that didn't happen.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't happen. There's a lot of half-baked ideas in the world. And yeah, it's ultimately very confusing. Like the fact that Merlin isn't in this movie, but
he gets a mention.
Yeah, a
silhouette and they talk about him doing stuff, and you're like, he clearly had a big agenda and a plan.
Well,
where the fuck is he?
He apparently sent...
Well, he sent the mage,
the
right?
Mage.
He sent the mage.
I wonder if she could either be Guinevere or Nimue in the sequel.
He made Excalibur. I don't think the mage was Nimue. I think it was Guinevere. So when the water recedes, you're left to potentially theorize, like, did Merlin do that? Did the Lady of the Lake do that? Is that just happening because it happens? Is that how magic works?
It would have made a lot more sense if the Lady of the Lake had done
it. I don't know. Yeah, like, so it's a lot of... I don't know, it's... a weird world to set it in, and I don't know, I wonder where the first decision was to decide, like, giant elephants.
It's happening.
Going sort of back briefly to the idea of, like, the montages also in this movie, one we didn't really touch on that I think ties into this world building is toward the end when they give a brief history of how Excalibur came to be.
Yeah.
Where they mention that, like, okay, so Merlin stole Mordred's staff, somehow turned it into a sword, gave it to the Lady of the Lake. The Lady of the Lake
bound it to
Pendragon's bloodline.
Yep.
And then gave it to him. But
this process also shattered the ancient tower that Vortigern was then rebuilding for himself.
Right. And also, there's some fucking bullshit about Vortigern having to rebuild a tower. But anyways, why does this matter? Who cares?
Also,
why are we giving this an info dump right now?
Way too late.
The
siren note hag lady says that he needs to top the tower with the silver from Gaul.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. It sounds very important when they say it.
And then never mentioned again.
Silver from Gaul. What if I get the silver from somewhere else? Is it invalid?
What if I get it from Salamanca?
Yeah, it sounds like some sort of very mystical ritual to complete this, like, ultimate altar of evil, I guess. But
it would have been cool, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Well, it's also confusing because ultimately, you get the whole backstory about Excalibur, but at the end of the day, Excalibur barely matters in this movie. It really just empowers Arthur to just kill a bunch of dudes. But you didn't need that for Arthur in this situation. Do you know what I mean? Like, it has so little to do with the actual story but so much of the movie is tied up in it. I don't know. It was very weird. So then when we got that history, I was like, I don't care. We've already moved past the point where the sword matters.
Well, there's the line that you said you liked, Lee, where the mage is talking about where Arthur is, like, standing in the marshes.
He wants to... Yeah, he doesn't want to use the sword still. It's after the Darklands nonsense.
Yeah.
And she's explaining to him, like, you have to fucking pick it up in both hands. And, like, you didn't act... Like, when you were in the Darklands and you saw the vision, did you, like, look away or did you face it? And she says, like... Like, you have to face it. Like, I don't like to face it. No one wants to face it. But, like, that's the difference between a man and a king. And that was a really cool line.
Yeah. And a structure, as, like, a structure to hang Arthur's character growth on,
yeah,
that's a fine thing to do.
It is.
That makes sense. But it never comes back again.
No, it never does. And the idea, like, the idea, not beyond, like, you know, a specific concept of, like, fear or, like, responsibility. The idea of, like, a character saying to another character, like, hey, like, listen, we're all, like, we all have problems that we don't want to face, but, like, that's what you have to do as, like, the one that's going to lead all of us.
Well, and they seem to feel like when he flashes back to that memory for a final time right before he defeats Vortigern...
Uther looks up and gives him a thumbs up.
Right, hey,
good job, son.
Well, he's like, you don't have to run anymore. Here's the sword. Yeah. All right. Where it becomes this weird, like, interactive memory. They seem to think, like... You know what? Resolution gained. And I was like,
there's this moment of like, oh, look at Uther giving his son a proud look.
Yeah.
I'm like, what does he give a shit about?
Why?
We don't care about Uther. And why would he? He never really knew him. But then the other crazy thing to me about that is, then what are we thinking the issue was? Just having witnessed it to begin with? And that now we have also witnessed with him that vision a million fucking times.
Now
we're just like okay with it?
Yeah.
So
and why is Arthur in a better place now?
Right. Basically. So and also, what was the issue that we... Yeah, just, what was it? Why?
The movie is weirdly hung up also on Uther in general. Like, it really wants there to be some sort of relationship between Arthur and Uther. Oh, God, it sounds like... I was thinking, like, the David Letterman, Uma Oprah thing from the Oscars.
Yeah.
Arthur, Uther. But, it's the easiest way to give someone emotional pathos in a movie is to be like, you know, like, oh, relationship with your daddy.
Dead
like, this is it. This is what you're all about. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in the story. Uther has very little to do with the mythos. The movie doesn't give him a reason to matter. It's just, like, the one neat thing I think the movie does is it makes him the stone that the sword is lodged in.
Yeah.
Like, it's an interesting little touch, and it's almost supposed to be symbolic of something. Or
but
like,
then it never comes
yeah,
back.
Yeah, no, it never quite hits
then.
It. Like, you think watching it, like, oh, this means something, but the movie is just sort of like, no, you're going to sit down, forget it.
Also, it's sort of a break from... Arthurian tradition, too, in the sense that, like, this movie makes out Uther to be like, yeah, we did Camelot, it was great for a while, and then we fucked up. Whereas, like, in the real Arthurian legend, no, like, Uther was kind of just another shit king fighting with other shit kings over pieces of England.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, frankly, again, is kind of, if you want to do some daddy issues, that's a little more interesting.
Yeah, right? Like your daddy wasn't a great guy.
Yeah, like, or maybe, like, and again, even, like, maybe if Arthur had this idea that his father was, like, a great king, like, my dad was a king, he must have been great, and he finds out, like, no, your dad was kind of shitty. Like, your dad really didn't care about the people, he cared about himself, he cared about the sword, he cared about fighting others. Like, you have to do better. Anyway, so we handled looking to score briefly at the beginning, because Lee really likes the score.
I do really like
the return of looking to score. What's the composer's name again?
Daniel Pemberton.
Okay, because I'm not really familiar with him.
Yeah, so the other bit I really liked plays at his execution. It's sort of like the theme that plays during the solemn moments of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly how it goes, but there's some string bits, and that's sort of like the solemn moments. And any sort of action sequence has a lot of really good, like, hurdy-gurdy as percussion.
Yeah.
Backed by a lot of, like, weird vocal stuff. And it, I don't know, it's just really, it's sort of minimalist and effective.
It is, and it makes you feel kind of, aerobic, almost.
Yeah.
And it's good, I like, almost literally, because it's someone's
Oh yeah, if next time I go running again, like, that's absolutely my soundtrack.
I thought it was very effective, it definitely pumps you up. The music is good.
Yeah, there's also two songs, I know you didn't like one of them, but there's a song in the beginning, in some sort of other language, maybe it's Celtic, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
and there's a sort of another more, like, English folk song towards the end that plays when, Arthur's on a trip out, this guy who's, like, he's on drugs.
Going back to Camelot.
Yeah, he's sort of having, like, a trippy ride through the woods.
Yeah, and there's, like, a tree woman who looks
like seeing dryads and shit. And they play this, like, really cool English folk song. And I'm really into that.
Which also, by the way, for what reason?
Play what?
I'm saying, for what reason did he need to be drugged out?
Oh, because he ate...
Well,
he had to have venom from
bite.
The snake.
Yeah.
So that the snake recognized
it
as, like, an ally.
And again, which could be... resolved if she was the snake and therefore didn't bite him.
However, I think it's cool. I think it is cool that he had to, like, I don't know, be, like, drugged up or something.
Well, it's a neat looking idea where she, like, sends a snake up his arm to bite him and, like, to inoculate him, but it also fucks him up a little bit.
I also love that line exchange where he's like, I don't like snakes. She's like, no one likes snakes. It's good.
She just looks like a mom, right? She's like, suck it up.
Yeah. Like, very tough love.
No one likes to do this.
Yeah, but music, fun, good.
Yeah. All right, so do we want to go to fixes?
Sure. I had two different concepts because I couldn't decide how I wanted this movie to go.
Yeah.
And so the first one is like, let's do a Guy Ritchie King Arthur movie.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're doing a King Arthur Guy Ritchie movie, this is how I want it to go. I want it to be more about Vortigern and taking him down. And I want it to be... I want Arthur in it, obviously, but I like Merlin a lot. And so I'm bringing Merlin back, and it's sort of a dual protagonist scenario now. And it starts with the whole tower thing, which is a real bit of legend, where Vortigern's trying to build this tower, and it keeps falling down, and he doesn't know why. And his soothsayers are telling him, like, well, you gotta sacrifice people. That's what you gotta do. And so when I liked this idea of... They bring Merlin in because they think, like, this is the right boy to sacrifice. And they bring Merlin in, and Merlin's like, well, no, you idiot. Your tower's on unstable ground. There's a lake below it. And then he also then proceeds to tell this cool doom vision of, like, I see two dragons. One of them is your symbol. And, like, there's another dragon. He's eating it. Like, your days are numbered. And that's sort of the beginning to, like, that whole saga. And so my pitch is basically taking some bits from my favorite version of the Arthurian legend, which is the Lawhead books, and also, like, my own and stuff and mixing in some Guy Ritchie elements. So Merlin is raised by... Celtic druids in this version, but it's sort of it's sort of imagine like if in modern day times if you were raised by a crazy cult in a crazy like remote part of the country. That's what I want it to be like. I want it to be like no one thinks this is like, it's not like fun mystical druids. Like Merlin is raised by these people and he's very like, he breaks out of his programming from a pretty young age, or he's like, wow, these guys are fucking nuts.
Yeah.
Like, I hate this. And he, like, runs away because he's like, these guys are fucking crazy. And the druids thought Merlin was, like, going to be some sort of, like, great promise. Like, he's going to fix all of our problems. He's going to kick out the foreign invaders. And, like, and Merlin's like, no, fuck you guys. You guys are nuts. And then so Merlin comes to, like, London or some city to be, like, a small-time con artist using, like, some of the druidic tricks he's learned. So he's not really, he doesn't really buy into this like magic nonsense. This is a very low magic version that I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really buy into all that, but he's like been trained to sort of like do all the spirit vision, you know, like soothsaying shit. Mm-hmm. But he sort of uses that to sort of spin and like, so he is the new racketeer Arthur, where he's like a small time con artist type guy. And they bring him, they do catch him because like for whatever reason he fits the bill for like someone they think they should sacrifice in this sort of like, cause these German kings think that, like, they're strong believers in, like, blood magic and, like, oh, if you, like, do XYZ and you kill people, this is how you get things done. And Merlin's like, well, this is also bullshit. But, like, I'm smart and I'm savvy and I can, like, talk my way out of this. And he does it, but he does have a vision of, like, and, like, it's a real vision that he doesn't want to, like, necessarily acknowledge, but he sees, like, you know, this image of, like, a boy, like, who is Arthur, like, overthrowing the throne. And so I want to take it from there where, like, at some point, he would have to meet up with Arthur, and, like, he would have to train Arthur. But that's where I want it to be, like, keeping that sort of Guy Ritchie
flavor,
I would do that. The other version is much less sort of fleshed out, but this is me taking it and saying, like, this is just a full-on, I want to have a fun magic video game movie. And so I'm still doing the idea that, like, so the German invaders do this, like, again, this very high-risk, high-reward blood magic thing, where, like, you kill a lot of people, you can do a lot of shit. Most of the good shit that you can do involves, like, killing nice people,
right.
And it's decidedly evil for that reason. But you can also use your own blood to do things. And then, whereas the magic that is native to the country is, like, very nature-based, and in that case, it's just, like, it is, like, a war between different styles. And it would be sort of telling the story of, you know, England successfully retaking, you know, their kingdom.
But with having crazy magic
shit. But with having crazy, crazy nature magic shit.
I like it.
Killing off all, like, you know, fighting off the evil blood magic.
Chris?
I did somewhat of a little pitch here. It's not as... No, it's pretty sketchy. But it's... I think I wanted to start on a very entertaining and sort of badass caper to that Merlin will embark on to steal Excalibur back from a Saxon warlord who has taken it because they believe they can give themselves power with it. He can return it to the Lady of the Lake, kind of making her swear that the Pendragons can only wield it. That Uther Pendragon is too young to be dying of this sickness that neither his doctors, rather, nor Merlin can figure out or cure. Merlin suspects magic but is unsure. Young Arthur is feeling the weight of responsibility and has become a very serious and taciturn young man to the point that Merlin worries he'll be a joyless and dour king. He tries to make life an adventure and tries to guide Arthur in absence of his parents. Uther dies, leaving behind a disturbing omen of a snake biting and killing a golden eagle. Merlin recognizes the snake as a familiar of Queen Mab. I was also, as I was thinking about it, I was like, that's Sam Neill version. I'm going to take some of that. In this, she's going to, sort of the same deal. She's like the magical, chaotic queen of the fairies. With the help of his apprentice Nimue, Merlin susses out Mab's plot to eradicate the Pendragons while keeping Arthur safe. And basically he does that, and we have a sequel hook that Nimue has sensed another one who has become a vessel of Mab's power, and that would be Morgan Le Fay teeing that up for the next movie.
Alright, so the basic thing I had, like, if you weren't even going to try, like, if I wasn't even going to try and make a pitch, like, the loosest thing you can really say for this is, one, it should be a TV show, and two, it should just be a TV show of the, like, the Thomas Mallory Death of Arthur book, because, like, in a post Game of Thrones world, like, that is, like, that's what you want. Like, mm-hmm. it's like, it's these stories, characters wander in and out, minor characters become very important later on, there's lots of sex, there's lots of disgrace, there's lots of, like, squabbles, like, this is everything you want. And so, if I am to assume that probably at the point that this was greenlit, that's what Warner Brothers wanted, why would you have Guy Ritchie do your movie? Because if you want to do, like, Game of Thrones-style King Arthur, Guy Ritchie is not your man to do that, because Guy Ritchie is going to give you a King Arthur Guy Ritchie movie, which he did. So, I don't understand about that. But, like, the loosest thing is what I want is that. If I were to do a pitch for a movie, what I have is this. So, the thing to start out with is the stories of Arthur and the knights are supposed to be inspiring. They're dealing with the concept of what heroics are, what virtue is, what it's like to see those things upheld and then to see them fall. So, like, that is something that I think this movie misses completely. Like, if that is the basic idea of, you know, who these heroes are that created Britain and why they're important to us, there is fucking none of that in this movie. So, it's a simple thing. The characters have to be likable. There's a weird trend with some Warner Brothers movies to make inspiring characters conflicted or mopey or ambivalent, and that is not what this movie needs, which is what they did to Arthur. The King Arthur stories are basically like Captain America for Dark Ages children, so you have to have something that's more along the lines of that. Like, it's only tragic at the end if you care about who these people were and how good they were initially and how much better they made things once before failing. So a big thing in this movie is there's going to be no Excalibur in this. The Sword and the Stone will feature in, but Arthur is unable to pull it from the stone earlier on in the movie when he just tries to on a LARF. The movie has to be much more magical in general. On that note, the mage will be the Lady of the Lake to give her some sort of direct connection to the Arthurian legend and to play into an idea that she has some sort of connection with nature and control over that as her magic. Arthur and his lads are all younger, like 18 or thereabouts, so they can actually have a coming-of-age story. He's going to be raised by Ector, who fulfills more of the role Bedivere did in this movie, where he was a knight once, but now he's kind of washed up and disgraced, and, you know, he's living in the shadow of his former self, kind of, because as the kingdom has fallen all around him, like, no one needs him, and he is just sort of, like, this sad character a little bit more. Guinevere is one of his lads as well. You can keep Bedivere and George and Percival and Tristan, but Lancelot will not feature in this whatsoever. Vortigern will not be in the movie at all. The true antagonist is ignorance and unenlightenment. There's a more minor issue with Mab as a hands-off villain.
You're doing the Sword of the Stone, basically?
A little bit. As Mab, who would be more of a hands-off villain in this movie and probably feature more in a sequel, Arthur has to inspire the people of Britain, whom Mab is happy to keep ignorant and preoccupied, to seek control over the country. At the end, Arthur temporarily defeats Mab by drawing the fabled sword from the stone because Britain believes in him and he is facing Mab, which makes him worthy in their eyes to be their king. The fight will destroy the sword, but the lady implies that he'll be presented with a new one when the time is right. As the movie ends, Merlin emerges from a deep slumber in a cave and presents himself to Arthur and all of Britain. Also, Merlin is totes fuckable.
Merlin should always be hot.
Ray Winstone.
That famously fuckable Ray Winstone.
Wow. I know, I have no idea, but I'm just thinking along the tones of like that BBC series where
the BBC,
like,
NBC
where they were like Center. Super gay. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they were very gay.
By the way, I agree in theory that, like, yeah, producers want Game of Thrones style heavy drama. I would kill myself if I had to sit through a King Arthur version of that, because, like, it's not what I'm here for.
No, I don't want, I mean, like, I don't want to see, like, a depressing, realistic Arthur, you know? Like, I don't want to see it to be, like, you know, where people keep dying and it's sad.
Yeah, I don't want to hate every character in the King Arthur cycle.
I think it's more like, do you just mean in terms of it being,
it's like a sprawling, a sprawling fantasy, lots of gore, lots of sex, lots of, you know,
which is present.
Because I think ultimately King Arthur is a story of, like, ideals.
Right, and that is an interesting game, where Game of Thrones wants to be more of, like, a, like, quote-unquote realistic take on, like, high fantasy. Arthur is not supposed to be that.
No, and Arthur is like a tale of victory and yeah. tragedy.
And again, and if you ignore that, you get like the Guy Ritchie movie, where you sort yeah. of fundamentally miss the point of who Arthur is as a character.
Yep.
All right, so will we recommend the movie?
I would. I think yeah, it's fun sure. enough to sit through and get some cool fight scenes.
Yeah.
Some bad fight scenes, yeah. but some cool fight scenes
too. I did think at some points, like there's a few good lines, but I also wondered, like, is this a good movie to have on mute, maybe? Like...
Nah.
No,
because I like that.
You're going to miss the richiness if you put it on mute.
That's true.
Also, you're going to miss that hot breathing taste.
Yeah.
I would recommend it with the caveat that, one, again, it's not that good, and two, it's kind of a long movie. Like, it's not...
It's like 2.5, isn't it?
I think it's just over 2. Like, it's yeah. not the longest it's movie a little ever bit. Done. Like, it's not like Lone Ranger long, but it's...
There's some boring bits of this movie.
There are. There are, like as we, you know, said many times throughout this, there are things that could have been trimmed with very little effect on the story.
I mean, it drags in the middle, for sure.
I think it drags a lot over the story, to be fair. I don't think it's just a thing of the middle. But yeah, you know, it's... Hey, you watched it on HBO Go. It's streaming right now. So, you know, yeah. it's free if you have HBO Go. Go ahead and watch it. As always, you can find us online at www.drappack.com. You can find us at facebook.com/whywatchpodcast. Nothing's on Twitter, so don't even think of looking there.
It's dead.
And you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher, and you can rate us there.
Please
and
do.
Just give us a rating. Give us a little review. And if you don't want to write a review, just write the name of your favorite host.
Okay.
Wait for that popularity. You yeah. start.
And then wait for my kudos to come rolling
who,
in.
Who has the most friends?
Yeah.
All right, so should we heavy breathe?
We're going to heavily pant it out.
Yeah.
We'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a mini episode. And
see ya.
Until then.
Ha 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 ha